This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, October 23rd, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, scientists say climate change is one of the most serious crises facing the global community, but its absence in the U.S. presidential campaign continued in last night's debate. Residents in Panama protest the government's plan to privatize land as a controversial U.S. trade deal gets ready to go into effect. And we'll go to Pakistan to hear from the classmates of Malala Yousafzai, the teenage girl shot by militants this month on her way home from school. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in headlines. Human Rights Watch reports today that Syrian government troops continue to use cluster bombs. Government officials deny the charge. Human Rights Watch Arms Director Steve Goose.
This denial is meaningless. We've identified through the videos and the testimony at least 46 cluster bombs have been used. Those 46 cluster bombs contain some 6,000 individual bomblets that now have rained down upon the Syrian population.
Goose notes that cluster bombs must be deployed from the air and the opposition does not have an aerial force. 111 states have either signed on to or ratified the Convention on Cluster Munitions, an international treaty that bans such weapons. Neither Syria nor the U.S. are signatories. Fighting continues in several cities. Reports today include shelling in Damascus, children among the dead in an attack on a bakery in Aleppo, and cross-border anti-aircraft fire damaging a health center in Turkey. A former CIA intelligence officer who blew the whistle on the torture of a suspected al-Qaeda member pleaded guilty to one count of outing a secret agent today. As part of a plea agreement, four other charges were dropped. John Kiriakou will spend 2.5 years in a minimum security prison and pay a $250,000 fine. Hundreds of Kurdish prisoners have joined a hunger strike that began in mid-September, calling for improved conditions for the imprisoned leader of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports.
The Turkish Human Rights Association reports that at least 400 prisoners in 50 jails have joined the protest, which began in mid-September. The inmates are serving sentences for links to the PKK, which is waging a guerrilla war against Turkey in its demand for language and cultural rights for the large Kurdish minority. The PKK's leader, Abdullah Öcalan, is imprisoned on an island in the Sea of Marmara, where he has been held largely incommunicado since his capture in 1999. The PKK is considered a terrorist group by Turkey, the United States, and the European Union, and continues to battle the Turkish army in deadly clashes, its members sheltered in remote mountain bases in southeast Turkey, Syria, and northern Iraq, areas where ethnic Kurds are in the majority. Turkey has a history of hunger strikes. A dozen inmates died in 1996 while protesting poor prison conditions. This week, a statement signed by more than 100 academics and writers warned that many more imprisoned youths could die if the government doesn't accede to their demands. Jacob Resnick, Salamania, Kurdish Autonomous Region, Iraq.
Florida prison officials are preparing to execute a schizophrenic death row inmate this evening, barring last-minute action by the U.S. Supreme Court. John Ferguson was granted a temporary stay over the weekend, pending a Friday hearing on his competency. But last night, a split appeals court unexpectedly lifted the reprieve. Convicted of killing 8 people in South Florida in the 1970s, Ferguson's history of psychiatric diagnoses predates his crimes. Actively delusional, he believes he was jailed as part of a communist plot, is the Prince of God, and will be resurrected as such. A South Florida judge found those beliefs in keeping with the Christian faith and therefore ruled Ferguson competent. Ferguson is scheduled to die at 6 p.m. Eastern. The double murder of an agrarian rights organizer and his wife in northern Mexico sparked an overnight sit-in protest at the state government palace of Chihuahua. Shannon Young reports.
Ismael Solorio and Manuela Solis were ambushed and shot dead Monday afternoon while traveling along a rural highway in the northern state of Chihuahua. Solorio was a local leader with El Barzón, a national movement of middle-class farmers and rural landowners. He was an outspoken critic of a Canadian-owned mine carrying out exploratory work in his town's communally owned lands. The area is also the site of an intense conflict over scarce water resources. A week prior to his murder, Solorio and members of his organization officially notified Chihuahua's Secretary of State that he had been receiving death threats. Members of El Barzón and human rights activists held a sit-in at the Chihuahua State Government Palace last night, demanding the government take action in the regional conflict. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
Last night, Eugene, Oregon became the latest in a growing list of cities nationwide to ban single-use plastic bags at the checkout counter. FSRN's Jess Burns has the story.
The new law is intended to encourage the use of reusable bags at grocery and other retail establishments by banning single-use plastic bags and charging at least 5 cents per paper bag. Councilors voted down an amendment that would have made the nickel fee optional. Eugene City Councilor Alan Zelenka.
Without the 5 cent fee, what we'll see is a massive shift to paper bags. Just exactly what happened in Portland when they didn't put the 5 cent fee on. They saw a 491% increase in the use of paper bags.
Eugene's law will go into effect in 6 months with a possible 1 year extension for businesses that can prove the ban will cause undue hardship. Portland and Corvallis have both passed such bans. A statewide bag ban stalled in the legislature last year. Jess Burns, FSRN, Eugene.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In last night's final debate between President Barack Obama and challenger Mitt Romney, the conversation veered from Middle East foreign policy to education to the upcoming threat of a budget sequester. But despite a campaign season marked by droughts, natural disasters, resource-driven conflicts, and failed global carbon negotiations, both candidates were completely silent on climate change. Some environmental experts say the increasingly unstable climate will impact nearly every major issue the next president must tackle, including key decisions in U.S. foreign policy. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
Despite a national grassroots campaign over the past month to pressure the candidates and four debate moderators to address the issue of climate change, the exclusion of the issue from Monday night's debate made this year's election nearly the first since the mid-1980s to avoid the topic. Ann Peterman with the Global Justice Ecology Project called this omission criminal and said the next president will have to confront increasing famine, mass migration, and resource wars caused by climate change.
There's a food crisis already, which is being greatly exacerbated due to climate change. We saw the droughts that happened in the Midwest U.S. Africa has been experiencing droughts for years now. Water is another major issue. Water is drying up all over the world. Fresh water sources are becoming more and more scarce. Tornadoes of a scale we've never seen before, historic floods that happen every other year. A lot of things are going to be impacting the American people because of climate change, and the fact that they're just completely ignoring it is, I think, criminal.
Though President Obama did not mention climate change in any of the debates and has given the topic a little time on the campaign trail, his administration has pursued some carbon-cutting policies at home and abroad. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton told a crowd at Georgetown University last week about how her department factors climate change into its work.
Energy cuts across the entirety of U.S. foreign policy. It's a matter of national security and global stability. It's at the heart of the global economy. It's also an issue of democracy and human rights.
Clinton outlined several areas of concern, including potential resource conflicts and environmental disasters in international Arctic waters. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta also said this spring that climate change is a major national security issue for the United States. Yet much of the Obama administration's foreign policy decisions have not been beneficial to the environment, especially when it comes to trade. Both candidates have promised to increase American exports, but Tyson Slocum, a researcher with a watchdog group Public Citizen, said the next American president needs to reimagine how the U.S. makes trade deals with other countries.
Our current trade system under the World Trade Organization encourages long-distance trade between countries that is often very highly carbon-intensive. It often disadvantages locally sourced production.
Like NAFTA and CAFTA, the trade deals signed by President Obama with Colombia, Panama, and South Korea also give corporations the ability to sue countries that have environmental protection laws. Similar provisions are likely part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which the U.S. is currently negotiating behind closed doors with several partner countries. Slocum and other experts say a binding international agreement is the only hope for avoiding irreversible environmental destruction. The next round of climate negotiations kicks off next month in Doha. But Peterman says the U.S. record at these talks, including under President Obama, makes her pessimistic.
The role of the United States at the UN climate conventions has been obstruction, and to infiltrate the whole process with these market-based mechanisms like carbon trading that are all about creating a new market for corporations to make money off of climate change.
United in avoiding the topic of climate change, Obama and Romney also agreed on a number of points in the final debate, including harsh economic sanctions on Iran, the use of drones for targeted killing, and the timeline for withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. But there are other candidates for president who have alternative domestic and foreign policy proposals. The public will have the chance to hear them Tuesday night, when the presidential candidates for the Green, Libertarian, Justice, and Constitution parties will debate in Chicago. The moderator, Larry King, will ask questions submitted by the public online. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
In last night's debate, Obama and Romney spent time on foreign trade with China, but the Republican nominee also cited another region.
The opportunities for us in Latin America, we have just not taken advantage of fully. As a matter of fact, Latin America's economy is almost as big as the economy of China. We're all focused on China. Latin America is a huge opportunity for us.
Under President Obama, a controversial free trade deal with Colombia went into effect this year, despite continued killings of labor leaders and concerns about human rights abuses in the country. And next week, a trade deal with Panama will go into effect. Anti-corruption advocates have criticized Panama for providing tax havens for wealthy corporations, and its policies have drawn protest from within the country. This week, residents of Colón are under a curfew after protesters hit the streets in response to the government's plan to privatize land. A video posted on the Panama news site shows police in Colón with weapons drawn, kicking and punching a man who lies on the ground. Shots can be heard in the distance. The response from police led to the death of at least one person, a 9-year-old child, last Friday, according to Reuters. For more, we're joined by Larry Burns, director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to FSRN.
Hello, Dorian.
Over the weekend, there were protests in Panama. The specific issue is the government passing a law to sell land in the free trade zone near to the opening of the Panama Canal. It's a plan backed by President Ricardo Martinelli. What's behind this move?
Well, we should realize that the Martinelli government is one of the most corrupt governments in all of Latin America. There have been repeated protest marches launched by the poor in various sections of the country. The president has had to back down on any number of occasions when he pushed legislation through that had only the narrow interests of his cronies in mind and not the general population. Free trade port in Colón has long been in existence. There are several thousand buildings there, businesses employing something like 30,000 people. So it's a very important part of the country's economic life. And as when the Panama Canal was expropriated in 1999, all of the assets of the canal were turned over to the government, and the government since then has been siphoning off the funds at a very fast pace.
With this change in the land there and the land ownership, possibility of privatizing parts of it, how would that change things for residents who are living there?
Well, the principle involved here is, who does the land belong to? Now, up to now, the land has belonged to the people, and which means that the situation, whatever it may be on a given day, is not eternal. It can be changed because the public ownership of the land. Once the land is privatized and you sell off the land, Latin America's experience has been that the revenues from the privatization of the land disappears very quickly into the pockets of influential local citizens who have the ear of the government. So what will happen will be that this asset, the Freeport, once sold and liquidated, will not be there to replenish the funds for improving civic life in the city of Cologne.
There's also a free trade deal between the U.S. and Panama that goes into effect next week. The trade deal is going into effect under the Obama administration, and President Obama also ushered in a trade deal with Colombia, despite concerns about labor abuses and killings of labor leaders that went into effect earlier this year. In last night's debate, as we heard, Republican candidate Mitt Romney spoke briefly of economic policies in Latin America. Is there an indication of the policy in Latin America that would shape up under a Romney administration?
Well, there has not been any distinguishing characteristic of the Obama administration. Obama has no Latin American policy. And as for Romney, his Latin American policy is embarrassingly primitive. And so free trade benefits whom and for what? The question is, it's a very mixed record. And usually the poor suffer most, and the generality of the population suffer most, and large business interests usually do quite well.
Larry Burns is director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. He joined us from Washington, D.C. Larry Burns, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dorian.
In Richmond, California, a proposed penny-per-ounce fee on sodas and other sugary drinks is on November's ballot. Big beverage companies are trying to defeat the effort after failing to stop a similar effort in New York, where Michael Bloomberg successfully championed a ban on the selling of sweetened drinks in containers larger than 16 ounces. FSRN's Sally Schilling reports.
Richmond residents have mixed feelings about taxing sugary drinks in their city.
It's a start in the right direction.
If it goes for the kids, that's all that matters.
Are they now going to go after meat that's bad for your heart and arteries? Are they going to go, are they going to go after all foods?
The money, the taxes, it's supposed to go into a general fund to help with the community, and that's not going to happen.
City Council member Jeff Ritterman is a former cardiologist who wrote Measure N. He says the estimated $3 million a year raised by his proposed soda tax would go towards city programs to fight obesity.
Swimming lessons is $86,000. We can pay the entire budget for the Richmond Half Steppers, the kids track team, that's $26,000. We could pay scholarships at $100 each for 3,000 kids to do after-school sports, that's $300,000. We can put 10 teachers in elementary schools teaching gardening.
To promote his measure, Ritterman displays a large container of sugar in a red flyer wagon. He talked with children at a farmer's market about his 10-gallon jug of sugar.
That's how much sugar.
That's a lot of sugar.
Each of the children in Richmond on average takes in a year just from sodas.
Crazy.
Isn't that a lot of sugar? Can you imagine?
I didn't think kids ate like that much in soda, like sugar, every year. That explains a lot, actually.
According to campaign finance reports, groups including the California Center for Public Health Advocacy have spent about $50,000 on the campaign in support of the soda tax. They're up against the more powerful American Beverage Association, which represents big soda companies including Pepsi and Coca-Cola. The association has been the major funder of the local political group Community Coalition Against Beverage Taxes. The group's campaign statements show it has spent more than $2 million to fight the soda tax. Political consultant Chuck Finney was hired to run the beverage company's campaign against Measure N. He says Ritterman's campaign is a mere stunt.
What he's doing is he's running around town, dragging around, a little red wagon filled with a plastic container of sugar as a publicity stunt, and he's blaming soft drink manufacturers for the obesity problem in this country, when the data show that that just isn't the case.
Finney says the 1 cent per ounce fee on businesses selling sugary drinks would be passed along to consumers.
It's going to result in increased costs on a whole range of goods for Richmond residents as businesses pass along the cost of the tax and the cost of implementing and complying with it. Those taxes equal a cost of living increase in a city where a lot of residents just can't afford one.
But Ritterman says he has seen firsthand the connections between sugar intake and heart problems. He says that Finney is only campaigning against the tax because he is getting paid to do so.
I was a doctor in this community for 30 years. How dare he say something like that? He comes from the outside getting paid money, and I care about the welfare of the children in Richmond, and he comes here just for a paycheck, and then he has the audacity to say things like that. I just think that's wrong.
A similar tax measure is on the ballot in El Monte, California, where the American Beverage Association is also spending heavily to defeat it. An advisory measure is also on the ballot in Richmond that would recommend the city spend the funds raised by the soda tax on anti-obesity programs. Sally Schilling, FSRN, Richmond, California.
At FSRN, we depend on listener involvement to make our program work. We invite you to join us for our 2012 annual meeting on Sunday, October 28th at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. At the meeting, you'll hear updates on the newscast and the organization and where we plan to go next. It's also a chance to bring your questions and suggestions to the FSRN team. Join us. This meeting will be via teleconference. You can attend by dialing 760-984-1000, code FSRN. That's 760-984-1000, code FSRN. For more information, visit fsrn.org.
The Pakistani teenager who was shot by militants while coming home from school on a bus continues to recover in a hospital in the United Kingdom, where doctors say they still have concerns but that her condition is stable. The Taliban said they targeted Malala Yousafzai because she was promoting secularism and Western thinking in her support of girls' education. People across Pakistan and the globe condemned the attack in the Swat Valley. FSRN went to the scene to talk to students and survivors. Janine Etter reads for FSRN reporter Gabe Matthews.
On a narrow road in Mingora, near homes and small fields of maize, a group of local boys points out where militants were waiting to shoot 14-year-old Malala Yousafzai after she finished her day at school. Malala wasn't the only one shot. 16-year-old Kainat Safraz was sitting next to her when the militants opened fire.
Our school day had finished and we were coming home on the school bus and discussing our homework when suddenly our bus was stopped and a young man climbed into our bus. I thought it was a rehearsal for a drama. I was shocked and started crying as it was unusual and unexpected. I saw a gun for the first time in my life. He asked which one is Malala and then started firing at her. I saw Malala bleeding and then I realized I had also been shot in the hand. She was bleeding so much, I fainted.
Kainat says when she recovers, she will go straight back to school because education is the only way women can change their lives. Kainat and another girl who was also shot in the attack are being treated at home, while Malala was taken to the United Kingdom. Local youth say they are praying for Malala's recovery. Kainat and Malala's school is quieter than usual because some parents are keeping their children at home. Grade 11 student Aslam Zaib was only 150 feet away from where Malala was shot.
It's very dangerous for her here. She can't live here anymore because the militants have said that they will kill her if she survives. The militants do not want girls to be educated, but Malala speaks out in support of girls' right to get an education. She was targeted because of this. She is brave and bold like Benazir Bhutto. What happened to her has made everyone afraid, and only half our classmates are here today.
Malala is a role model for boys and girls across Pakistan. Many young students want to be like her. Although many youth did not want to be interviewed in fear of their safety, grade 5 student Idris Sajjad said he was willing to talk on mic about the incident.
I was extremely sad when I heard she had been shot. She is the daughter of my father's friend, and she is very brave. After the incident, I am scared for my safety because she didn't do anything bad, but she was targeted. She is a peace activist.
Another student, Muzaffera Khan, says her sister was near the bus when Malala was shot. She says her family often spoke highly of Malala.
She has received many awards and prizes because she works hard. I want to work harder than Malala and be more popular than her. I want badly to make my country better and for it to be respected around the world. I want to be a good doctor or an engineer.
Fellow students aren't the only ones inspired by Malala. She made a big impact on Muzaffar Khan, her biology teacher.
I have taught around 3,000 students, and in that time I have never seen anyone as intelligent as Malala. She is an extraordinary genius. At first I did not believe the stories about her, but after 3 months of teaching her I realized her potential and realized she was a genius. I was afraid that geniuses do not live for very long.
Extraordinary minded wala.
He says Malala and her father have been receiving death threats for some time, and it was affecting Malala's studies.
She was looking very upset or alone, and she was not teasing other students as well as do not committed any misbehavior to the teachers as well. But always I saw him sitting silent.
Malala continues her recovery in a UK hospital, where doctors are cautiously optimistic about her recovery. The other student, critically wounded, Shazia, is out of danger but remains in the local hospital for treatment. Reading for Gabe Matthews in Swat Valley, this is Janine Etter, FSRN.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.